Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Samuel Tadros makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Mr. Tadros was educated at the American University in Cairo and did his master's at Georgetown University in Washington. He's contributed to the Hoover Institution's Working Group on Islamism. He's a lecturer at John Hopkins University in Washington, but principally he's the senior fellow at the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom in Washington, D.C., and he is the author of Motherland Lost, The Egyptian and Coptic Quest for Modernity, and Reflections on the Revolution in Egypt. And tonight, Samuel Tadros is going to speak for us on the future for Christians in the Middle East. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for the kind introduction and for hosting me here today. The title of the discussion here today is Do Christians in the Middle East Have a Future? What a depressing title. Even posing it as a question, regardless of how one answers it, is a sad thing to do. But sad times these are indeed. The train of destruction that is the Islamic State, ISIS, as people know it, has taken Middle East Christians in Syria and Iraq by storm. In Lebanon, the ruling formula that the country had adopted for so many years is crumbling, strained by the growing Sunni-Shiite war raging in neighboring Syria, leaving the fate of Lebanon's Christian as a question mark. In Egypt, the hopes of deliverance at the hands of the newest military ruler have not materialized, with the situation of Christians in that country continuing to deteriorate. These times are indeed depressing, where hardly any corner of the Middle East brings any good news about the region as a whole or about its Christians in particular. But before we begin to talk about whether Christians do have a future in the Middle East, it is perhaps important and necessary for us to begin by talking about their very past, about who those people are, about how they survived for such a long time, and about why this moment in time might be so different. Christianity was born in the Middle East, and for many centuries in late antiquity, Christianity was a Middle Eastern affair. That fact seems to be forgotten today. Perhaps it is the years of isolation of Middle Eastern Christians from the rest of Christendom. Perhaps it is the decline of Middle Eastern Christianity, no longer at the center of world of Christendom, that drove people to forget that for many centuries, the center of the world of Christianity was in the Middle East. Of the four churches or the four pillars of Christianity in late antiquity, three were in the Middle East: Alexandria, Antioch, and Constantinople. The early ecumenical councils of the churches were all held in the Middle East. The leading figures in those early debates and schisms were all Middle Eastern Christians: Arius and Athanasius, Nestorius and Cyril. These were all Middle Eastern Christians fighting, debating, defining for us what it meant to be Christian and what we believe until today, the Nicene Creed being formed by these Middle Eastern Christian men. The School of Alexandria, renowned for its theological acclaim, producing men like Clement of Alexandria and Origen, set the date of Easter for the rest of Christendom, to its west in Tunisia, it was Saint Augustine writing his writings that defined Christianity. To its east were the Cappadocian fathers in what is today Iraq and Syria. Pillars of the church until today, Basilius and Gregory. In the deserts of Egypt, monasticism was born at the hands of Saint Anthony the Great. Now, this important role that Christianity played, or that the Middle East played in world Christianity, began to end by the 5th and 6th centuries. Two things led to this, basically. The first is that the growing fights within Eastern Christianity had bloodied it, had torn it apart with the growing schisms inside of it. In 431, the Church of the East, or the Assyrian Church as it is known today, broke from the rest of Christianity following the Council of Ephesus. 20 years later, it was the turn of the Copts in Egypt to break following the Council of Chalcedon in 451. Followed by the Syriacs and the Armenians, they formed what we know today as Oriental Orthodox, different from the Eastern Orthodox of Greece, Russia, Serbia, and those countries. The second major event was, of course, the coming of the Arabs and Muslims from the Arabian Peninsula, creating a geographic border, a wall of separation between Eastern and Western Christianity, a wall of separation that continued very much until our modern times. Under the Arab-Muslim rule, the role of Christians, many factors of what formed that role are important for us to highlight as they continue to shape the way Middle Eastern Christianity behaves and is formed. The first is, unlike in the West, where the struggle between popes and between rulers, between Friedrichs and Henrys and the popes, of who has power in Europe at the time, in the East, the Middle Eastern Christians, the churches of those people, had to live under the framework of a different religion, of rulers that come from a different religion. But that did not mean completely that they were isolated from politics. In fact, it meant that these churches often act as the representatives of their community. Popes became the leaders of those communities, both internally and in front of the state. A pope was expected to collect the jizya, the money that the Christians were supposed to be paid for the state, and was punished by the state if he didn't. That role of the popes, of the clergy, as leaders of their community, continue with us until today. It naturally meant, with the church playing such an important role, that the state, the caliphs, the rulers, would find it important for them to interfere in church affairs, to try to appoint bishops or popes, to try to meddle into church affairs. The legal framework, or the framework within Middle Eastern Christianity that they lived in under the rule of Islam, was that of zimmitude. Zimmitude was two forms, basically. The first is the legal framework of zimmitude, i.e. that these were protected second-class citizens, expected to pay the jizya, a certain amount of money, in return for not serving in the military, in return for not being able to carry arms and to protect themselves. But it was not only a legal framework, but also a social one. Zimmitude meant that these people, the verse that we have in the Quran that was the basis for that formula, was until they pay the jizya while they are in a state of subjugation, a feeling of inferiority, until they recognize that they are inferior. What this meant was basically that this was the land of Islam. Islam was to be supreme in that land, and as such, Middle Eastern Christians needed to acknowledge this. Not only them, of course, only, but also the Jews that lived in that at that time in the land of Islam. What this meant in practice was certain restrictions on their lives, all intended to make them feel inferior, to make them acknowledge the superiority of Islam in its own land. Not being able to ride horses, for example, was something written in the codes of the time. not being able to have any Muslim servants, not being able, certain dress codes they were supposed to wear at certain times, hazel clothes, at certain times black, blue. The color itself changed, but the idea of that they were different and needed to be identified as different was constant throughout those years. The no new churches to be built in that land. All of this was framed under a pact invented in the Middle Ages, but given a heritage of or a frame of history called the Omar Pact, supposedly conducted between the second caliph of Islam, Omar ibn Khattab, and between the Christians of the Syria or of the Levant. That framework, of course, necessitated a response by Middle Eastern Christians. The first response of these people pertained to language. These people talked a variety of languages, Coptic in Egypt, Aramaic, Syriac, the various languages of the region. Arabic became the dominant language, and naturally these churches had to adopt. To become civil servants, not high-ranking ones, these were not always open to them, but to survive in that state, they needed to learn the language of the rulers. And they did. Naturally, what followed was the continued decline of these Middle Eastern original languages. Copts in Egypt today no longer speak Coptic, for example. They don't even know what it means. A few clergymen might know the language, but for the rest of the population, the religion itself became Arabized. They became talking, the language of prayers became largely Arabic in their churches. Conversion was naturally the second. We don't have accurate figures from the time of when conversion happened. When did the Middle East become a majority Muslim? But it was a slow process. Sometimes it was violence. Often it was simple assimilation, following the people, your neighbors, and becoming like them in step by step throughout the centuries. Sometimes it was the poorer segments of the Christian population that could not afford to pay the jizya. At other times, it was the top levels who sought to acquire the benefits of becoming Muslims by rising up in the bureaucracy and the civil service. The fate of Middle Eastern Christians in those years was often a twin-faced story of survival and decline, of endurance and of decay at the same time. Years of persecution were followed by years of peacefulness, of tolerance. This up and down continued with us until modern times. Modernity was brought to the region by a curious man, a French officer, quite ambitious, by the name of Napoleon Bonaparte, decided to come to Egypt. The land of the pharaohs was a curious place to start an empire for the French in the East. He arrived in Alexandria on the 1st of July, 1798. When news of Napoleon's arrival came to the Mamluks, the rulers or ruling fighting class of Egypt at the time, a Mamluk replied, "Let all the Franks come, and we shall crush them beneath our horses' hooves." The use of the word Franks and not Frenchmen is, of course, interesting, and reflects the mentality of the time. The last time the East, the world of Islam, had met the West was during the Crusades, when the Franks and all the other Europeans had come and had occupied the Holy Land for a century and a half, 2 centuries, but in the end, Islam had won. They had been kicked out. The idea that something had happened in between, that the Franks were no longer Franks, but modern Frenchmen, was completely absent. When the two armies finally met in the Battle of the Pyramids 20 days later, the hooves of the horses did not exactly crush the Frenchmen. The Mamluks were slaughtered, facing the modern weapons at the time of the cannons and the weapons of the modern French army. This, of course, brought the crisis of modernity to the Middle East. The question, as Bernard Lewis, the famous historian, framed it, what went wrong? Why have the Franks turned into Frenchmen? And why have we not? What has happened to them that made them now more successful, superior, technologically advanced, weaponry, in all these factors? And the more important question, how can we catch up? How can we become like them? Modernity, of course, gave birth to a number of important phenomena. First was the European involvement in the region increased. The French were kicked out in 3 years by a combined British and Ottoman military campaign, but the British themselves occupied the country 80 years later. The Levant, French influence grew there. In the Maghreb, in Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria, the countries there quickly fell to the French rule. Hardly any place in the Middle East was completely isolated from this growing European influence. Modernization at the hands of the rulers quickly followed. Native ones and the occupiers brought modern schools, modern ideas. Christians largely benefited from this. They were more willing, by virtue of being Christians, to become or to join the modern schools that were being opened by both the modernizing rulers and by the missionaries at the time. They were more willing to take the chance of that modern education offered to them. But besides education, modernization and modernity brought the question of nationalism to the region for the first time. For the first time, the question of who we are, how to identify ourselves, was brought to the region. Before that, everyone was an Ottoman subject. The Ottoman Empire ruled from Morocco until Iran. It had reached the gates of Vienna twice. It had been one of the grandest empires of the Muslim world. Suddenly, that empire was falling apart, and people began asking the question, are we Muslims? Are we Christians? Are we Ottomans? Are we Arabs? Are we Egyptians? Are we Syrians? What do these all mean? Who are we? That question began first, of course, in the western provinces of the empire, in Serbia and Greece, where we had the Greek Revolt in 1821, other parts of the western provinces, European provinces of the empire, but it quickly also spread to the east, where the question of identity would dominate the region. Ethnic wars grew. We had the famous massacres of Christians in 1860 by their Druze and Muslim neighbors, giving birth, of course, to immigration. And, of course, the phenomena that was born out of this question of modernity was Islamism. The answer by some Muslim intellectuals to the question of what went wrong and how can we catch up was naturally a return to the form or the days in which Islam was dominant. By returning to those older days, by returning to the Salaf, the devout predecessors, ancestors, thus we can again become supreme and become successful in the world. Pertaining to Middle East Christians, the impacts of modernity were varied. First, it made them a go-between, a bridge between the East and the West. They, understanding with one leg in each world, they could become the necessary bridge between the two civilizations. Often it was Greeks and Armenians that acted as ambassadors, emissaries, translators for the Ottoman sultans in their courts. Other Middle Eastern minorities began to follow the same route, becoming traders with the West, representatives of Western governments, taking that role as a link between the two civilizations. It gave them, of course, opportunities of advancement. Better education made them more equipped with the challenges of this modern world. It also opened the door for the foreign missionaries to come to the region. Protestant missionaries, Catholic missionaries had always been there in the region for centuries before that, but Protestantism began to reach the region and the missionaries to come, often with a mixed message. My favorite story of Protestant missionaries was of a Protestant missionary reaching Asyut in the south of Egypt in the 1860s and meeting the local bishop, informing him that he was here coming to bring Copts to live with Christ. The confused bishops could not understand, and his answer was, "But we've been living with him for 1,800 years. When did you get to know him?" So the missionaries had a various impact, challenging the authority of the local churches, taking some of their members, but also bringing modern education and such advancement to Middle Eastern Christians. Some Middle Eastern Christians benefited from the idea of protectors, of foreign protectors, of foreign powers being interested in their fate. Russia quickly became the protector of the Orthodox in the region. France acted as the protector of the Catholics, especially the Maronites in Lebanon. In other cases, the foreign occupiers were actually not favorably disposed towards the minorities, such as the case of Egypt, where the British actually benefited or thought that ruling through the Muslims was much better than dealing with the Christians and attempted to exclude them from the civil service. But in general, modernity posed for Middle Eastern Christians for the first time an opportunity to change their reality. And they began to take that opportunity. For many of them, it was a demand for equality. Modern ideas coming from Europe, not only nationalism, but the ideas of the French Revolution, of being equal citizens, of citizenship in the first place. So we see this growing tendency of Middle Eastern Christians demanding the removal of the legal framework of similitude, being allowed for the first time to serve in the militaries, no longer paying the jizya. These reforms, for example, in the Ottoman Empire are implemented in the 1850s and 60s. So we see that growing tendency towards more rights and equality. But also we see emigration. The first Lebanese and Syrian Christians emigrating to the West, to Northern America and to Southern America, following the 1860s massacres of Christians in the Levant. And lastly, it is Arab nationalism, curiously born at the hands of Middle Eastern Christians in the Levant, who think that the Arab identity, that being Arabs, can then become a suitable identity that would frame, would bring Christians and Muslims together instead of the religious divide. So in a curious twist of fate, Arab nationalism is born at the hands of Middle Eastern Christians. Antoine Saada, the leader of the Syrian Socialist Party in Lebanon, at the hands of Michel Aflaq, another Christian in Syria, the Ba'ath Party, George Habash and Naif Hawatma, the Palestinian Christians. It's Middle Eastern Christians that champion that idea in its original form. But the dreams of independence are quickly turned into nightmares. Instead of independence bringing more equality for Middle Eastern Christians, it brought in more challenges for them. First was the forced Arabization of the schools, of education, of every aspect of life. Arabization meant, of course, the removal of the uniqueness of cultures. The Aramaic, the Syriac, the Coptinus could no longer find its place in the public square, for everyone had to adopt the collective identity of being Arab. In the Middle East, you see, identity is always dealt with as a hat. You can either be a Christian or an Arab, a Muslim or a Syrian. You cannot be both. You cannot wear two hats at the same time. So the forced identity, the forced Arabization of those societies posed a challenge to the local communities, with that conformity being enforced on people. Often Arabization was not that different from Islamization. The case of Egypt, for example, where the free officers coming, led by Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1952, began an Arabization and Islamization of the educational system, excluding Copts, reinforcing the idea that Egypt is an Islamic country, despite maintaining a secular framework. The independence also brought authoritarian rulers to power after coups, in the case of Syria and Iraq, or with the one change by Nasser in Egypt. These authoritarian rulers, of course, inflicted everyone. They brought the famous intelligence services, the police states, the tortures, affecting both Christian and Muslim throughout the region. But the fight with the West and Israel especially touched Christian lives. As non-Muslims, their loyalty was suspect. If the West was the enemy, no differentiation was often made between the West and Christianity. It was all one thing. And if Israel was the enemy and the Jews were the enemies, then Middle Eastern Christians were also suspect. Where did their loyalty stand? Was it with the West or was it with the countries themselves? The fight with the West, of course, brought that pressure on Middle Eastern Christians, a pressure that continued We saw the horrors of the Lebanese civil war, 1975 until 92, the Islamism growing as a threat in the region, in Egypt in the late 80s and early 90s, in Syria until the massacre of the Brotherhood in Hama in 1982-83. We saw that rise of Islamism as a threat. But the Islamists were not the only threat to Middle Eastern Christians. Often it was the states themselves claiming to be secular. They had to out-Islamize the Islamists. They had to enforce their own discrimination on Christians in order not to allow the Islamists to take the high ground in that fight. We saw restrictions growing on the building of churches in Egypt, where in order not just to build a church, but even to build a bathroom next to a church, you needed the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, to sign a piece of paper allowing that. That restriction remained until 2005, when finally, for the first time, building bathrooms was something the president no longer had to deal with and was left to local governors. Immigration to the West was naturally an answer by many Middle Eastern Christians. The decline of Middle Eastern Christianity is not only a story that began with ISIS or with the horrors that we see in Syria and Iraq, but due to economic constraints, due to persecution, to discrimination, is an ongoing story. You have here in Australia, in Canada, in the United States, those growing Middle Eastern Christian communities coming to those countries in the 70s and the 80s, fleeing those threats in the region. And lastly, it was the relationship with rulers that many Middle Eastern Christian churches developed. Perhaps it was a lesson of minorities throughout time. The ruler can protect. The ruler can stop the pogrom from taking place. The ruler can offer some sort of protection in the face of the Islamist threat. So it's no surprise, given the role that the churches had played historically from the start of the rule of Islam as representatives of their community, that these churches would develop close relationship with the ruling regimes as these were their protectors. And then came the Arab Spring. Now, Christians were hardly fooled by the promise of the Arab Spring. True, some of the youth thought that a moment of enthusiasm, a moment of change can take place. But for many of those minorities, it was again the eternal lesson of minorities. A lesson learned by Jews throughout the Middle Ages in Poland, for example. Better the persecuting tyrant than the mob. With the tyrant, you can buy him off, you can use international pressure, you can persuade him. With the mob, you stand no chance. Perhaps the Arab Spring naturally brought three fault lines to the region. The first was that the collapse of regimes was often occupied by a collapse of the state itself. This was true in countries that had no real basis for their identity, no collective identity, where the borders had been arbitrarily drawn by the occupiers, the French and the British or the Italians, and where no basis for a collective identity had been developed. This is true of Libya, for example, where the collapse of the Gaddafi regime was not only a collapse of a regime, but meant the collapse of the very idea of a Libyan state. It was true in Syria, in Iraq following the fall of Saddam Hussein, in Yemen. That collapse of the state meant a collapse in basic law and order, security, any form of protection that existed for people. It naturally meant not only the growth of Islamists on the national level, but also the growth of Islamist power on the local level, where you'd have local Islamists in a small remote village in Egypt attempting to enforce their views on the local Christians, forcing young Christian girls to be veiled, for example. Things on the local level and not just the national changes. A growth in kidnappings of Middle Eastern Christians in Egypt, in Syria, in Iraq, in those countries. A growth of blasphemy accusations on the local level, where a Christian would suddenly find himself accused of insulting Islam for posting something on Facebook. There's a case in Egypt where someone received 6 years in prison for being tagged in a photo on Facebook. Anyone who uses Facebook, of course, knows that being tagged is not something you actually do in the first place. But those accusations began to grow. The second change was, of course, the second problem that the Arab Spring introduced, is that basically by removing the power of the dictators, by removing the police state, it brought to the forefront the hatreds that had been brewing for centuries between ethnic and religious groups. Now, these hatreds are not the creation of those regimes and are not the creation of the West, for example. They've been there for centuries. But by removing the dictator, in the case of Iraq at the hands of the American invasion in 2003, or in the case of Syria at the hands of the people rising in the rebellion against their dictator, by removing those dictators, those ethnic and religious divides became a clear divide that people are fighting over. So we saw the fights between ethnic and religious groups growing in the region. Of course, the major fault line of those fights has been the Sunni-Shiite divide, where Sunnis and Shiites, first in Iraq, starting with the Americans removing the largely Sunni regime of Saddam Hussein, and the Shiites gaining power due to their majority, but also in Syria, where the Sunni majority have been for decades persecuted and dominated by an Alawite minority. In those cases, once the regimes had fell, the Sunni-Shiite divide became the most important, with Sunnis and Shiites fighting in the region, and of course with the regional protectors and financiers, both in Iran and Saudi Arabia, playing Syria as a proxy war, for example, or Iraq, and continuing their fight there. Of course, with Christians caught in the middle. The Sunnis and the Shiites had their own armies and their own backers. The Christians had none of these. Lastly, it is, of course, the rise of the Islamic State, of ISIS, of its specific kind of horror, different from all the horrors that we had seen before. It's remarkable that 14 years after 9/11, we're now thinking about Al-Qaeda as the lesser of the evil, because we've seen the worst evil in the form of ISIS. God knows what we might see in the next 10 years or so. So where does this leave Middle Eastern Christians? Which brings us back to the question, do they have a future in the region or not? Now, unfortunately, the answer is not that optimistic, to say the least. Of course, it's important to mention that even before the rise of ISIS, Middle Eastern Christianity was in decline. In 1910, Greater Syria, the Levant, was about 30% Christian. Today, Syria is, before the revolution, was about 8% Christian. God knows if there's a Syria in the future, whether how many Christian, what the Christian percentage would be. This is true across the region. Iraqi Christians before the American invasion, 1.5 million. Today, less than 300,000. So that decline has been going on for a while and is not only the result of the growth of ISIS today. But certainly ISIS is the latest threat. And unfortunately, it's a threat that we don't seem to have an answer to. Despite the military campaign led by the West for the past year, ISIS has not been defeated. It's in fact growing. Not only is it now in control of a major piece of land stretching from Iraq to Syria, it also has the allegiance of various groups, from Boko Haram in Nigeria, from three Libyan affiliates in Libya, from a local presence in the Sinai, of the Wilayat Sinai, even in Afghanistan, we are now having an affiliate of the Islamic State, ISIS. So that threat does not seem to be in any way in the next or near future about to be defeated. Which of course means that these Middle Eastern Christians threatened, specifically those of Iraq and Syria mostly, are not likely to be able to go back home anytime soon. The outside, even if we think that we are able to defeat this threat, that in 5 years' time we will be able to end that horror that the Islamic State represents, the natural question is, what if they go home? Will they find their homes empty? The answer is unfortunately no. Like Polish survivors of the Holocaust returning to their homes in Poland to find Poles living there. People that lived there for 10 years during the World War II and the aftermath and not willing to give up those places. Returning to homes to neighbors that, to say the least, did not open their mouths when they saw you rounded up, did not open their mouths when they saw the letter N in Arabic being written on your homes, did not open their mouths when you were being slaughtered. How would you live again with these neighbors in the same place? And if that was to happen, who guarantees for you that you will be protected in the future, that this will not happen again? Some may have the idea that regional migration, that today many Middle Eastern Christians have escaped to Lebanon. Lebanon is a country that was built as a refuge for, or as a country originally for Middle Eastern Christians, for the Maronites specifically, and it's now home to over 1 million Syrian refugees, many of them Christians. But the story, we must remember, is not always a happy one. Iraqi Christians escaped to Syria following 2003, following 2006, when the sectarian horrors were really there at play and Christians had no protection. And in Syria, they thought, at least for 5 years, that they had a safe haven. Only then for them to be joined by the Syrian Christians themselves, escaping from the horror that became Syria. Is Lebanon stable? For how long? For how long can Lebanon sustain itself while this Sunni-Shiite divide, while this Sunni-Shiite civil war is raging on in its neighbor Syria? Is Jordan stable? Another place that has been welcoming to Christians. How long can Jordan sustain the fact that it has 1 million refugees, adding to the already divide in the country between the East Bankers and the West Bankers, coming the Palestinian refugees? So regional migration might be a temporary solution, but it's unfortunately not a permanent one. Others might have the idea of allowing the Christians to protect themselves, giving them arms. We have, of course, a lesson in the region that the only minorities that have managed to survive in the modern Middle East were the ones that basically acquired military capabilities. The Jews, the Kurds, the Druze and the Maronites, these are the minorities that were able to defend themselves by either creating a state completely, the case of Israel, or creating a semi-autonomous state, the case of the Kurds, or at least protecting their own mountains and being able to live there, as the case of the Druze and the Maronites. So some might have the idea of arming these Christians. But unfortunately, there is no longer any Christian presence in a specific geographic location that would allow the creation of a safe haven or of a country of their own. There's simply no place for them, no mountain for them that would protect them. And the geography that for so many centuries favored the minorities, whether it was the south of Egypt, away from the center of authority in Cairo, that led to a huge Christian presence continuing in that place, or the mountains of the Levant that allowed the Maronites to survive. Geography is no longer able to defend them against modern weapons, against technology. So the reality is that for many Middle Eastern Christians, the only answer is emigration. To pack their bags, to pack 2,000 years of history, and leave the lands of their ancestors, and go to the West hoping for an open door there. The world, of course, and the Middle East will lose a lot by their immigration. The rich historic mosaic that is the Middle East will no longer be there. Instead will be a Middle East that's conforming, of one sects, of one groups, that will no longer have the Maronites, the Melkites, no longer have the Yazidis and the Mandaeans, this rich mosaic that so for so long has survived. It will no longer have those communities that were the bridge, again, between the East and the West. We have the lesson of the Jews that were kicked out of the Middle East, of how much Egypt, for example, lost by the fact that 100,000 Jews were forced out of that country. Recently, there has been a cure found for hepatitis C. Perhaps doctors here are familiar with the cure Sovaldi. The inventor of the cure is, curiously, an Egyptian Jew who was kicked out by Nasser, found refuge in the United States, and working in Emory University, provided the cure that remarkably is the most needed thing for the country that he comes from. Egypt has the highest hepatitis C rate in the whole world. So the Middle East will not only lose simply a small number of its citizens, large or small, it will more importantly lose many of the best educated people, many of the minds that would be able to build those countries. Now, I'd hate to end completely on a pessimistic note. I talked about history under the Muslim and Arab rule as a twin story of survival and decline. If the fate of Middle Eastern Christians in the East, in the Middle East, in their own homelands, is one of decline, it is one of flourishing in the West. In 1971, when Pope Shenouda became Pope of the Coptic Church in Egypt, there were 7 Coptic churches worldwide outside of the Middle East. 2 in Australia, 1 in Sydney and 1 in Melbourne. When he died in 2012, there were more than 50 Coptic churches here in Australia. A total of more than 600 Coptic churches around the world. 200 plus in the United States, 60 in Canada, even in Latin America, in places where you wouldn't imagine you'd find the Copts. Copts are living, are flourishing, are acquiring new converts. The Coptic Church today is a growing phenomena in sub-Saharan Africa, where 500,000 Africans find this church more appealing, given the lack of its any history of colonialism associated with it, and the very fact that it's an African church started in Alexandria in Africa. So while the story in the Middle East might be one of decline, of decay, the story of Middle Eastern Christians in the land of immigration might be the flourishing and the one of survival. Thank you very much.
So many thanks to Samuel Tadros. So now we come to question discussions. We have to the top of the hour, and there are a lot of people here, so if you keep your comment or your question brief. So I'll start with what I hope will be a brief question. As you're aware, there's a debate in Australia if we take more Syrians, should we give preference to those of an ethnic minority, which means essentially Christians of one kind or another, on the basis that the Muslims in time will probably be able to go back and the Christians in time will probably not be able to go back. How would you look at that kind of proposition?
Of course, the countries in the West are secular countries. We don't give preference in the West to a specific religion. The countries, whether it's the United States, Australia, or others, are built on this foundation that all men are created equal, that there is no preference given to a church or a community. However, we do recognize, and we did recognize in the past, that specific groups are facing a specific danger. And accordingly, we have given them special status. I'm talking here, for example, of Jews in the Soviet Union, where the United States, I cannot speak of the Australian experience, I'm not familiar with it, but where the United States pressured on behalf of Jews living in the Soviet Union to allow them to be able to immigrate to Israel, where that was used, included not only in discussions about religious freedom, but it was included in every discussion, even nuclear discussions between President Reagan and the Soviet leaders. So that kind of attention, specific attention or special status given to specific communities is, I think, natural given the challenges that these communities are facing. If Middle Eastern Christians are facing a specific challenge, then we're not protecting them because we're Christians and we want to protect Christians. We're protecting them because inaction is a form of action. By turning a blind eye to the reality that they are persecuted because they are Christians, by attempting to say, no, everyone is equal. No, not everyone is equal in the face of the threats that they are facing.
Ida?
What sort of assistance are Middle East Christians getting from some of the major world Christian bodies, such as the Vatican, the Russian Church, and the World Council of Churches?
At the level of support that Middle East Christians are getting from Christian organizations?
I think there has been significant humanitarian assistance. I here speak, for example, of the Catholic Near Eastern Relief that has been doing tremendous work, for example, in both Iraq and Syria, of various Protestant churches working with refugees in Jordan, for example. So there's been a strong level of humanitarian assistance. And of course, by this I don't suggest that not more is needed. A lot is needed. These refugees are living in horrible conditions. But outside of the humanitarian assistance, little assistance, political assistance has been given in this sense. The Vatican under Pope Francis has taken a much more bolder role in talking about Middle Eastern Christians. Pope Francis talks about them in many of his speeches. I would not be surprised if he mentions them when he's talking, giving his speech in front of Congress quite soon in the United States. He's been highlighting this as an issue. But traditionally, the Vatican and other Christian organizations have been quite sensitive to highlighting this issue. The reason is that they fear getting drawn into this clash of civilization, that there is this internal clash between Christianity and Islam, and feeding into this narrative, knowing that even any feeding of this narrative would not be good for Middle Eastern Christians and would not be able to protect them. The last thing that they've been fearing, of course, is that there's always this argument that, well, we don't want them to be associated with the West. If the West is helping them, if they've seen as the preferred victims, if the West is providing them with any special attention, then they will be blamed more and they will be punished more. Of course, the reality is that there's nothing worse than being annihilated, and that's the reality of Middle Eastern Christianity in a place like Iraq today. So it's not as if any Western assistance is going to make them be killed twice instead of being killed once.
Question, Reynolds.
I wanted to thank you very much for your talk. My question is, how are these churches, these Christian churches, organized? Sure. You talk of the Coptic Church in Egypt, but in the other countries, do they have some kind of hierarchy that might have some political influence? So could you elaborate on that?
Sure.
That's okay. So the question was, how are these Christian organizations helping?
Churches,
yeah.
Of course, these are hierarchical churches to the extreme, more than the Catholic even. We're talking, Middle Eastern Christians are divided into five groups. The first is, of course, a very small presence of Protestants due to the missionary work that was done. So you have small groups of Protestants spread throughout the region. Perhaps Egypt is the largest Protestant presence, but again, small groups. Then you have the Catholic churches, both Latin Catholic, i.e. people that follow the Latin rites in their services, and Eastern Rite Catholics. These are basically Orthodox people who converted to Catholicism. So you have the Maronite Church in Lebanon, for example, about 3 million people worldwide, about maybe half of them inside Lebanon and Greater Syria. You have the Melkite Catholic, you have the Chaldean Catholic, the Coptic Catholic, all these smaller churches. In total, something like 3 million Catholics living in the region. Then you have, of course, the Eastern Orthodox churches, part of the family of churches, Russia, Greece, and so on. So you have the Syriac Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox churches spread again throughout the region. Lastly, you have the Oriental Orthodox churches. This is Egypt, basically, the Coptic Orthodox, the Armenians, the Syriacs in Syria, and the Ethiopians. These form the separate family of churches that is the Oriental Orthodox. And lastly, you have the Assyrian Church, which had left the world Christendom prior to the Copts in 431, forming the Church of the East, or the Assyrian Church as it's known now. So these are basically the framework of the different churches.
So, okay, so there's a question here.
Just to help answer the question, I work at an organization called Open Doors. Oh. We work with persecuted Christians all around the world. And just sort of to help answer your question, there are a number of organizations that are currently in the Middle East. Our one is an example of that, Open Doors. There's also St. Barnabas Fund, yep, as well, Voice of the Martyrs. And there's also a number of UN-related NGOs that are also working with Christians on the ground throughout the Middle East as well.
Okay, so you've had a talk tonight which covered a whole lot of ground, but what's interesting is you've spoken a little bit, but not much at all, about Israel. So as you're presenting the troubles in the region between the Christians and the Muslims, and within the Muslim groups, the Shiites, the Alawites, the Sunnis, and others, I mean, Israel's not the major problem in this area, is it? There are all sorts of other problems, of which Israel is simply one problem.
Oh, of course. I mean, for long, the West, whether in scholarship or in media, focused on the Palestinian-Israeli problem as the center of Middle Eastern politics. In reality, it has never been so. It's a complete joke to imagine that someone living in the streets of Cairo cares more about what's going on in Jaffa or in Jerusalem than he cares about his own life and his own getting the bread and butter on his table in Cairo. So the focus on the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has often blinded people to the reality that there are so many other problems in the region, conflicts that are not involving Israel, that are not related to the Western colonialism or to that, but are indigenous to the region, that have been raging on for centuries and that have only been quiet because the dictators kept them quiet. Once those dictators are out, the lid is out and the gas is streaming outside.
Marco Forcio.
Thank you. Fascinating talk. There's been discussion in Australia about how our government and we should react. And one of the parallels, if you like, is being pointed to is how we in this country and how the world reacted to the events that took place in the Balkans and particularly in Kosovo. And I was wondering if, I've been thinking as I was listening to your speech about what are there parallels that the West particularly can look at in terms of how that, the breakup of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union states led to this terrible, these terrible atrocities. And the world was forced to react.
So there any relationship between...
I know there are differences, but... Yeah. Are there lessons for us that, we need to learn?
So just for the podcast, are there lessons out of how we handled the Kosovo experience?
I think there are. For a long time, the West ignored what was going on in the former Yugoslavia. It took Srebrenica, it took a massacre, an enormous massacre, to finally move the West into action. We haven't had the big massacre yet. So far, we've had the small massacres of people being killed in the tens on a local level, on a more daily level of people, women being enslaved, for example. We have horrible stories of the number of Christian women that have been enslaved by ISIS, and, of course, Yazidi women as well. One hopes that it doesn't take such a big massacre before the West has moved. The world, I mean, the plight of the Syrian refugees has been going on for 4 years now. But it's the fact that they're going to Europe now that finally has Europe moving. If it isn't that they're knocking on Europe's door, it would simply be someone else's problem and they would have been ignored completely. That's a sad reality because you cannot ignore that place as simple as it is. The Middle East is a center of world politics, whether it's the oil, whether it's the security of Israel, passage through the Suez Canal. What happens in the Middle East does not stay in the Middle East. It gets transported into the whole world and affects the whole world. So one hopes that one of the lessons of the Balkans is that we act soon before we see people massacred in the tens of thousands.
We've got to move on. We're getting very close to the end. There's a question there.
I'm wondering what America's doing for those Christians who are caught in this fight.
The question is, what is the United States doing for the Christians?
Nothing. That's a short answer. Partly it's a reluctance to be seen as favorable to Christians. Partly it's... not just the United States. To put it as someone framed it once, Christians, Middle Eastern Christians, are too Christian for the left and two Middle Eastern for the right. Many in the West cannot see Christianity except as the oppressing majority, as the European experience of religious wars, of the Catholic Church, of the Inquisition. That's the heritage when a Westerner, secular, thinks about when the word Christianity is mentioned. The idea of Christianity as the oppressed, as the minority, as the one suffering, is quite alien to them. So the Middle Eastern Christians are simply too Christian for the left to care about. But also on the right, this wall of separation between Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity has resulted in people not even knowing that there are Middle Eastern Christians. I sometimes get people telling me, I didn't even know there were Christians in Egypt. I assumed all Egyptians were Muslims. That's what we get in the news. The Middle East is the land of Islam and that's it. So their rituals, their ancient churches and hierarchies and patriarchs and the things they wear, these are all quite alien to even religious people on the right in the United States or elsewhere. So in Middle Eastern Christians are simply caught in the middle between this blind spot between the left and the right.
Final question, it's got to be brief. Yeah.
With the rise of ISIS and Islamic fundamentalism, what are the chances of moderate Islam standing up against fundamentalism in the Middle East?
So with the rise of ISIL, what's the chances of moderate Islam standing up?
Of course, it's always important saying not all Muslim, not even a majority, not even a significant minority is part of the Islamic State. Many Muslims are normal people who want to live their lives and continue their lives normally and are not interested in that kind of violence or that kind of radical ideas. But the reality is that the radicals always win. They are more willing to die for their cause. There are simply no, not that anyone would want to, but there are no secular suicide bombers willing to kill Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He has, on the other hand, 1,000 guys willing to blow up themselves and kill for their idea. That fact, that radicalization, that willingness to die for their cause has made them, unfortunately and in reality, more effective. They're able to defeat any competitors, any Muslim, moderate Muslim, raising his voice with a more moderate interpretation, is often accused of blasphemy. Blasphemy laws have not only been used against Middle Eastern Christians, but also against Muslims. We had the case, for example, of Nasr Hamid Abu Zayd, an Egyptian intellectual, who had a more moderate interpretation of the Quran and was willing to go beyond the radicals' ideas. And not only was his life threatened and he was forced to move to Holland, his wife got divorced from him legally because under the Islamic point of view, a Muslim woman cannot be married to a non-Muslim man. And since he had been declared a kafir, an unbeliever due to his moderate views, the court ordered that his wife is divorced from him. So the challenges facing these people that are willing to stand up and challenge the radicals are enormous and unfortunately have given them very small room to challenge them.
Samuel, many thanks. Just step aside for a second. Many thanks to our speaker tonight. There's a big audience here and there's a lot of interest in Australia in the Middle East for obvious reasons. Many people from the Middle East live here, including many Christians from the Middle East or their relatives from the Middle East. And so it's very important tonight you came along and gave us an overview, both historically and up to the current crisis of the fate of Christians in the Middle East. You're doing very important work at the Hudson Institute. I'm very pleased you could make it to the Sydney Institute tonight to tell us the story about Christians in the Middle East. And I hope you'll come back one day in the future. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.